Gene, I'll get this thing going. Okay. All right, in our study this morning, loosely in the life of David, we kind of expanded that a little bit, but we've been kind of creeping up on the life of David, and we met him last week, didn't we? He was selected as the next king of Israel following Saul. Who selected him? The people? No, God selected him, didn't he? People selected Saul, and God permitted that. He let them have what they asked for there. That kind of improves the old adage, be careful what you ask for, you might get it. But God selected David. And David was kind of a nobody from nowhere, kind of like most of us, wasn't he? The youngest of eight sons, no real distinctive roles in life or anything. He was a shepherd, taking care of some of his father's sheep. He possessed some unusual skills, some combination of skills that you don't often find, in that he was known to be, in his society there, a good, valiant warrior, and yet he was also an extremely good musician. That's like a SEAL Team 6 guy who can play the harp, huh? How many of those do you know? Doesn't usually happen that way, does it? But God is preparing him for his role, and his role is going to be the next king of Israel. And God needs to introduce the nation to David. And so we're going to have an incident here that will do that. This incident we're going to see here today, this encounter with Goliath, I think is probably designed by God to let the nation learn about David. Meet David, Israel. Here's what he's been doing lately. He's been killing these great big guys. And so his reputation and his character will become known well throughout the nation quite quickly, I think, after this particular incident. Now, usually this incident, which is probably the most well-known story in the Bible, would you think? Anything any more popular, any more well-known than this story? At least maybe as much, but not more. Oftentimes it's kind of trivialized. It's almost presented in a childlike fashion, you know, the storyline and so on. But the theology of the incident is rarely even mentioned. But there's a lot of things going on here that are theologically important and sound and illustrate our New Testament principles and theology. And there's quite a bit more to the story than what you oftentimes just see presented in children's books and things like that. So we're going to take a gander at this story this morning. I'm going to tell you some things about what's going on here, but I think there is a lot more than we normally hear that takes place in this incident. So David met Saul last week in chapter 16 as his musician for the purpose of trying to help his psyche. Saul is kind of mentally coming apart a little bit. And God has allowed this evil spirit to attack Saul and to afflict Saul. And it causes him some mental and psychological stress. But when David plays music for him, it relieves that. Apparently drives that demon out, away. And Saul feels better. And so David was recruited to play that role. They were kind of talking about, well, what can we do to help Saul? And some of his staff said, well, maybe we can get a guy in here that can play some music for him and help him and so on. And somebody knew of him. One of the young men answered and said, behold, I've seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, one prudent in speech, and a handsome man, and the Lord is with him. That's a pretty good resume, isn't it? Somebody knew a guy who knew a guy who knew David type thing, you know? So they recruit David into Saul's court to help him as a musician. He didn't come as a warrior. That comes later. He came as a musician. So that's how he got there. And verse 21 says, Saul loved him greatly, and he became Saul's armor bearer. And we'll see how long that lasts, but that's the initial relationship anyway. So that's how David gets in the picture. God called him. God selected him, brought him into the monarchy's court as a musician to help Saul. So that's how he's in the picture. So let's go on with the story and see what else we can learn about this guy. Verse 1 of chapter 17. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. Those nasty Philistines were always around battling Israel, weren't they? They were kind of a thorn in the flesh for much of David's and Saul's lives. And they gathered for battle, and they gathered at Sako, which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Sako and Azekai and the Ephes Dam, whatever the heck that is, I don't know. Basically, it's going to take place kind of over here on the border between Philistia over here in this general area. This is where this is going to take place. Remember, all of this was Philistine territory here. They had five cities that comprised the Philistia, and this meeting is going to be up here in that general area. And Saul and the men of Israel gathered and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with the valley between them. So you got the army separated by these two mountain ridges, and then there's a valley in between these two armies. Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Now that's about 9 feet and 9 inches tall. The guy, let's round him on up, say he bumps his head on a basketball goal if he walked under one. Okay, he's about 10 feet tall. He's a giant. Giantism wasn't terribly uncommon back at that time. There were a number of different clans of giants. I guess people that study this sort of thing maybe can understand it probably better than I do, but basically, to get this people this big, your pituitary gland has got to put out a lot more growth hormone than you need as you're growing up, and you get big, real big. And these guys were that way. Now, exactly what their problem was, who knows? Maybe it's some kind of a mutated gene that caused a tumor on the pituitary gland. I don't know what the heck is going on here, but he ain't the only one in the world that was that big. There's a bunch of guys around that are that big. And some of them seem to team up with the Philistines. And perhaps they were mostly warrior types, and that would be a good place for them to find a home, I guess. So here comes this guy, this giant of a man, nearly 10 feet tall, out representing the Philistines. He is a warrior. And he had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. That's about 125 pounds. So he's got on this metal coat, in effect, that protects his whole body. And he's got a helmet on, a bronze helmet, which protects most of his head. And the shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam. And the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. That's about another 15 pounds. So he's got a spear, the tip of which weighs about 15 pounds by itself. So this big, long, javelin-like spear is a big, heavy object in and of itself. And his shield carrier also walked before him. Note that statement. That's a very important statement in this scenario. Most of the time when you see pictures of David and Goliath in the kids' books or whatever, Goliath has got his shield on his arm. No, he doesn't. His shield carrier is carrying it out ahead of him. He does not have his shield on his arm. And we'll come back to that. So he comes out there all geared up and big and ugly and mean, and he shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you come up to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine, and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we'll serve you. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall serve us." So what they're doing here is they're having sort of a representative battle here. Instead of all these armies fighting one another, they're saying that we'll send a representative out there, you send a representative out there, and whoever wins, the other side has to serve him. That's kind of the scenario, the setup, okay? And again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." And when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Well, who wouldn't be? This illustrates the ongoing tension that we experience all the time in our sanctification as New Testament saints. And that's the tension between walking by sight and walking by faith. That's illustrated probably as well as anything in Peter's experience when he was out in that boat in a storm and the Lord came to him on top of the water. And Peter said, "Well, Lord, if that's really you, bid me to come to you." And the Lord said, "It's me. Come on over here." And Peter gets out and walks on top of the water because the Lord told him to do that, and Peter obeyed. Peter was walking by faith when he was on top of the water. And then he looks around and he sees the waves. He starts walking by sight, and all of a sudden he's fearful and he starts to sink. And that's what happens to us in life, don't it? When we walk by sight, we see things that scare the daylights out of us. And we sink. But Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:7, we don't walk by sight. We walk by faith as believers. We take God at His word and we do what God tells us to do, even if the circumstances appear contrary to that. So our tension as believers is to always battle out walking by sight or walking by faith. Saul and all of his buds, they're walking by sight. They see this monster of a guy and they're all scared to death of him. Understandably so. That's what happens when you walk by sight. You get scared to death. Now David, the same guy we met last week, the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse, he had 8 sons, we met him last week, and Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men, and the 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to battle. So Jesse has eight sons, 3 of them are in the army with Saul battling these Philistines. And the name of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and the second to him, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. So Jesse's 3 sons, 3 oldest sons, David's older brothers, are these 3 guys mentioned here, and they're in the army with Saul at this conflict. David was the youngest, and the 3 oldest followed Saul. Now, when we last saw David, he was playing the harp for Saul. So what the heck is he doing? David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. So David had 2 jobs. One of them was to play music, godly honoring music for Saul, which helped him mentally. And the other one was go over and take care of the sheep. He's a shepherd. So he's taking care of his father's sheep, and then he's going up to Saul's place and taking care of him when he can. So he's back and forth. So the Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. So they're getting to hear this guy's insulting rhetoric twice a day for 40 days. The God of Israel is being insulted by this guy twice a day. So Jesse, David's dad, said to David, his son, take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves and run to the camp to your brothers. An army moves on its belly. This army moves on mom and dad's belly. There was no supplying of food or anything from the army. The families had a supply for these guys if they got anything to eat at all. So that's what's going on here. Is David's going to take a little grub down to his brothers in the army here. So bring these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their household, or of their 1,000, and look into the welfare of your brothers and bring back news of them. For Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David is being sent on a mission at this particular time to take some food to his brothers. And he's taking kind of a special deal for the commander, you know, kind of a gift for him as well. So David rose early in the morning, left the flock with a keeper, and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. So when he gets there, he's hearing a big rah-rah from the army, although they're all scared to death of this giant. They ain't going to get near him. And the Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. So he's getting up close to the action here now, taking his food to his brothers. And while he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them. So this accusation that Goliath had been making earlier, David now hears. Okay, everybody else has heard it twice a day for 40 days. David hears it now for the first time. When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. And it ain't going to take him long to see that and pick up on that. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who's coming up? Surely he's coming up to defy Israel. It will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and give him his daughter to make his father's house free in Israel. So the crowd tells David, hey, this guy, he's coming up here giving us this stuff every day. Anybody that can kill this guy, the king will give him not only a daughter to wed, but will remove him from the tax rolls in Israel. His family will be free of taxation from then on. Quite a gift. Quite a reward. So David now knows, there might be something to be gained by killing this guy. So David spoke to the men who were standing by them, saying, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? You see, David is bummed out at Goliath before they encounter one another because Goliath is insulting David's God. Now, there's a whole bunch of other soldiers there don't seem to care a whole lot, do they? So let him insult God. I ain't going out there and getting near this guy. But David has a reverence for the things of God. He has a concern and a love for the things of God. It's like we saw in Jonathan earlier. They're similar in that regard. He is a man after God's own heart because he reveres Israel's God and the things of God. These other guys, they don't care. They're just warriors. They're just battlers. And the people answered him accord with his word, saying, thus have we done for the man who kills him. So David now knows what's at stake. And so he's, I guess, thinking about, maybe I should get into this situation. But his oldest brother, Eliab, I guess I say that, heard and spoke to the men, heard when David was speaking to the rest of the guys, and anger burned against David, and he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you've come down in order to see the battle. With brothers like this, you know, who needs enemies? It is not at all uncommon for the work of God to be opposed, is it? In fact, it's very uncommon that it isn't opposed. Somebody will always oppose something God is doing. It's, I guess, a little more difficult to accept and a little more irritating when that opposition comes from your own flesh and blood. Remember, the Lord's brothers taunted him, made fun of him. Said, go on up there to that feast. Hey, if you want to be known, go up there and do your thing in the crowd at Jerusalem. You're just up here in Galilee doing nothing. Nobody knows you're here. And they made fun of him and taunted him as he went up to the final Passover. Opposition to his ministry came from his own brothers. Same thing is going on here with David, isn't it? Of course, a lot before when the Lord got taunted. His own brothers are dumping on him. Now, I don't know if there's some green-haired monster at work here, some jealousy between the brothers and David. Remember, they were there when Samuel anointed David the next king. So are they jealous of him now? Picking at him in this way? You know, the Lord taught the disciples in Matthew 13 that the characteristic of this age in which we live will be a sowing of wheat and a counter-sowing of tares, an intermingling of the two. There will always be an opposition to the things of God going on. The same thing's happening back in this era. It's just in this case, it's David's own brother who are expressing this. And David says to him in verse 29, hey, what have I done now? Didn't I just ask a question? He's frustrated that his own brothers are picking on him, for he's just talking about the situation here. Clearly, there is jealousy in this family. Not totally unlike, I guess, what Joseph experienced from his brothers and all that. So he turns away from him to another and said the same thing, and the people answer the same thing as before. So David's getting the skinny on what the situation there is. And when the people heard that David was asking about this stuff, they take him to Saul, and Saul says, hey, let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. So David now, hearing the circumstances, hearing the reward for fighting this guy and all that stuff, you know, getting ramped up on what's going on, he volunteers to go out and fight this guy, this 10-footer. How much a guy weigh, you think, 10 feet? 500 pounds? 600 pounds, maybe? I mean, this is a moose of a man. And he's been a warrior all of his life. He's not a rookie. Goliath isn't. And David volunteers to go out and fight this guy. Where did he learn to walk by faith at this age? He's a young man. Probably late teens. Where does David learn to trust God like this in spite of what he sees at this age? I don't know. He spent most of his time out in the fields, tending those sheep. Now, I know you can meditate, have a lot of time to meditate out there by yourself and all that sort of stuff, but how do you learn this trust at that early age? Clearly, this guy ain't your average Joe Blow on the street. He's willing to go out and fight this guy. And Saul recognizes what appears to be a crazy situation here, and he says, you're not able to go against him. You're but a youth. Well, he's been a warrior from his youth. This is a experienced, monstrous warrior, and you, David, you scrawny little runt of a guy, you shepherd guy, you're going to go out there and fight him? You ain't got any credentials for this sort of thing. But David defends himself in verse 34 and says, hey, your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, and I went after him, attacked him, and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant, that's me, David, has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he had taunted the armies of the living God. Now, in defense of himself, David points out an experience he had in tending the flock of sheep. He killed some wild animals, a lion and a bear. Now, I don't know what kind of lion this was, probably a mountain lion. I don't think they had the African type of lions in this area, but even a mountain lion is not irrelevant. I mean, that's 150, 175 pounds of claws and teeth and general meanness. And a bear, even if it's a black bear, a smallish black bear, that's 200 pounds of claws and teeth. So he killed both of these animals in protection of the sheep. Now, he doesn't give detail. I don't know how he did it. This sling will come up here in just a minute. They were oftentimes called shepherd slings because the shepherds use them. I could see you could bounce a rock off of a mountain lion maybe and stun him, but I don't know, a bear, if you could knock a bear down with a rock or not. But at any rate, this guy, this young man, has killed both of these wild animals. I saw the weirdest thing online the other day. In Indonesia, they found this 22-foot-long boa constrictor with this big bulge in it. And they cut it open, and it was a missing woman in there. 57-year-old grandmother, he'd swallowed her whole. Animals are starting to kill people around this world, aren't they? Remember, one of the causes of death in the tribulation period are beasts. Beasts are going to be attacking humanity during the tribulation period at an unusual frequency, and they're not trivial. Animals this size can normally kill people, and David killed them. So he's no wussy. He is able to take care of himself. And David said, continuing on his conversation with Saul, he says in verse 37, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." Now that all sounds good and wonderful, but if you were Saul and this deal was made that if this guy wins, you follow the Philistines, you serve them, would you let this guy go out there and represent the entire nation to this guy, Goliath? Wouldn't you say, are you kidding me? You ain't got it, kid. You ain't going out there representing us. But Saul says, go, and may the Lord be with you. Have at him, guy. Go get him. Go put this big guy down. I'm not sure exactly what his motive was in doing that. He's got to believe, Saul has got to believe, unlike David, that David has no chance. I'm going to make an argument here in a little bit to tell you that it's the other way around. But Saul probably thinks David has no chance, but he lets him go. I'm not sure what the motive is there. That doesn't seem like the right thing to do, does it? Under the circumstances. But at least what he did do in verse 38, he tried to clothe David with some garments and armor that would help him. He put a bronze helmet on his head and he clothed him with armor. And David tried to work with that stuff. He girded his sword over his armor and he tried to walk, for he had not tested them. In other words, he's got on all this armor. It was Saul's armor, so you know Saul's a big guy to begin with, so probably David probably looked like a dwarf in all this stuff. He says, I can't use this stuff. It's way too big for me. I can't go with this stuff, for I've not tested him, he says. So David took all that stuff off. So Saul's attempt to equip him adequately ends in failure, and David has essentially nothing. So he takes his stick in his hand. I assume that's his shepherd's stick. That ought to be effective against a 600-pound, 10-foot-tall man, a stick. And he chooses for himself five smooth stones from the brook There just happened to be a brook nearby. Running water will smooth stones out, won't they? Good source of nice, good, round, aerodynamically sound rocks. So he gets him five of them. Why did he pick five? If he knew God was going to deliver him, why did he get more than one? And why five? Why not ten? I'll tell you why I think here in just a minute. So he loads up on these stones and puts them in his shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch, and his sling was in his hand. Now, a sling is not a child's toy. This is a very, very old, very well-known military weapon, a very comparable, capable military weapon. It dates back, they think, into the times of the Egyptians, like 3,000 years B.C. This thing ain't new. Armies used them all over the place. In fact, the scriptures even mention them a few times in the scriptures. Check this out. In Judges chapter 20, 15 and 16, from the cities on that day, the sons of Benjamin were counted, 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who were counted 700 choice men. Out of all these people, 700 choice men were left-handed. Each one could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. This is a weapon that could be mastered and be extremely accurate. Now, it's a standoff weapon. It ain't a hand-to-hand thing. You can't go up there and swing this thing at somebody with a rock in it and not expect to have your head chopped off. You have to use this thing from a distance. And depending on what you were trying to accomplish, that distance could be great. There's a number of other references to them in Scripture. Probably doesn't matter. You could basically get about 400 meters range from this standoff weapon if your objective was to just throw rocks from a long distance away, about 400 meters. That means you could go down here to the Dallas Toll Road and stand on the east side of Dallas Toll Road and throw these rocks and hit cars going down Inwood right here. 400 meters, four football fields away you could get out of one of these slings. Armies would actually mold out of lead. They actually called them bullets. They were the rocks, or the little stones that went in these things, and they would mold them kind of like a flying saucer, and they would have then an aerodynamic source to them, and so when you sling this thing from a long way off, it would glide well, and that's where you could get that kind of range out of it. Now, that's not what you would do up close to somebody. That's what you would do if you were just trying to lob stones at an army 400 meters away from you. Now, if you were that army that's getting the stones lobbed on it, what would you do?
Run
would be one thing. If you couldn't run, how about putting up a shield, right? This weapon was easily defeated by a shield. It's just a rock thrower. And if you had a decent shield, it'd just bounce off. Does Goliath have a decent shield? Not with him, not on his arm. It's out ahead of him. His shield bearer is walking out ahead of him with his shield. The easiest way to defend himself that Goliath had was just to put his shield up in front of his ugly face. But he doesn't have his shield with him. So David has his sling in his hand. Now, it doesn't mean that he has his sling hanging from his hand. The way they would do this thing is that these slings were just a pouch with two cords on each end, okay? One end they would tie to their wrist, so you didn't have to manage that end. That's going to stay on you. Or you could put it on a finger if you wanted to. And they held the other end so that when you slung this thing, the timing was a matter of when you release the one in your hand, and that's what guided the stone to its trajectory and so on. So when he says David has it in his hand, I think what he means is he's got the patch in his hand. Goliath doesn't see this thing. He doesn't know what David's got. He doesn't realize that David's got a very formidable standoff weapon in his hand, and he doesn't need to come up in Goliath's face, where Goliath could get him with his sword or spear. He thinks all David has is a stick. So the Philistine came on and approached David with the shield bearer in front of him. See, that's his great mistake. He doesn't have his shield at hand. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance. The Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. So he thinks David has come out there, this punk kid, with a stick to take out this 10-footer. And he doesn't realize that David has got a formidable weapon in his hand and knows how to use it. So there's no sense of urgency on his part to get his shield because he doesn't think he needs it. So he says, "Come to me and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." And David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you up to my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you." Now that's a pretty bold statement, and David has a stick. How's he going to remove his head? Beat his head off with a stick? I'll show you here in a minute. "And I'll give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth will know that there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." Remember what Jonathan said to his armor bearer when they attacked that garrison of Philistines earlier? He said, "Hey, God is not bound to deliver by a large number of people or a small number of people. He can do what he wants to do. You and I, us too, we'll go kick these guys out of that garrison and kill them off." And they did. They killed 20 of them. Jonathan understood that God is not bound by the size of an army. David understands the same thing. He says, "I'm going to take you down, and you're going to realize that there is a God in heaven that is our God." So it happened that the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, and David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. So he doesn't give him a lot of time to size up what's going on. David gets in this thing quickly. He's very agile, runs up and is in front of him. And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Now, before Goliath can know what the heck is going on here, David runs up, probably about as far as here the back wall from him. He loads that sling quickly and slams this stone into Goliath's forehead. And remember, he's got on a helmet. So the only vulnerable area that Goliath presents to David is his forehead. All right? A space about that big. That's all he needed. Hit him anywhere else in the face and it won't matter. Just make him even uglier than he already was. But that forehead is exposed to David's sling, and that's where he nailed him. And did so quickly that Goliath never did deploy his shield. His shield bearer is probably standing over there on the side doing this. Wait a minute. Let me get this shield to Goliath. Well, it's too late, pal. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling, and don't underestimate how formidable that sling was. It was not junk or a cheap toy. He struck the Philistine and killed him, but there was no sword in David's hand. All he had was a stick. Now, Goliath would wear his sword on his back. So when David hits him in the head with that rock, Goliath falls forward. Remember what happened to the Philistine god Dagon when they captured the ark? Falls over on his face. set him back up the next day, falls over on his face, and his head is removed. So what Goliath is picturing here is their god, Dagon, and he's on his face, and David runs up and grabs Goliath's sword, verse 51. He ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword. Now, where's the sword? On Goliath's back. So if Goliath's on his face, the sword is readily accessible. What if Goliath had fallen over backwards? 500-600 pounds laying on that sword, he might not have been able to draw it. But he can because Goliath fell on his face. So he takes Goliath's sword and chops his head off. He had no sword with him, but he just used Goliath and cut off his head. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they didn't exactly honor their bargain to serve the Israelites, did they? Now they hooked them. They ran. They got out of there. Now this whole incident is a very clear illustration, again, of the sovereign care of God of his people, divine providence. The timing of David's coming to the camp, the reasonable access to these stones that he needed for his sling, the ability to hide that sling so that Goliath doesn't even see it. A sword was provided to chop the guy's head off by Goliath himself. All of these things, and no doubt David was good with this sling. I don't doubt that he could have probably hit the guy in the head 4 or 5 times out of 10 at some reasonable distance. But he nailed him with one stone right in the right place in his forehead. The only place in his face area that was exposed, he nailed him right in the head there. All of that, God is in control of. So, David took this guy out. He illustrated in his behavior the principle of walking by faith and not by sight that we all try to struggle with every day. He illustrates our principle of Romans 8:31 that if God's for us, who can be against us? He illustrates the principle of 2 Peter 2:8 that God knows how to protect and care for his people while keeping the unrighteous under judgment for the day of judgment. So no matter the circumstances, God can protect us and take care of us. So several of our New Testament sanctification theorems, truths that we live by, were illustrated in this Old Testament incident involving David and Goliath. The situation was prosecuted by David in such a way that, and this may seem weird, but think about it for a second, Goliath had no chance. David wasn't going to get close enough to him to get killed with a sword. David's going to stand back. Goliath had no weapon with which to deal with David. He could have thrown his spear at him, but David's too agile. He would never hit him. And he didn't have his shield to protect himself against the one weapon that David did bring. So he had no chance of surviving this encounter. Goliath did. It wasn't David that was in trouble. It was Goliath that was in trouble from the beginning of this thing, because God had set this thing up to take Goliath out. And he had no chance from the beginning. Walking by faith instead of by sight rendered Goliath a dead man walking when he came out there that day. And David was introduced to the nation as the guy that killed Goliath, and he's going to spark a significant victory this day over the Philistines. Let's finish this story. So the men of Israel and Judah rose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley to the gates of Ekron. The others chased them back to their fortified home cities. And the slain Philistines lay along the way to Saraim, even to Gath and Ekron. And the sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. So they come back and take all the Philistines' weapons. So they outfit themselves, their armies, with these dead Philistines' weapons, and it was a real good day of outfitting their armies. And David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his weapons in his tent. It's a little difficult to understand exactly what David is doing, because at this point in time, Jerusalem is not Jerusalem. It's a Jebusite city. It could be called Jerusalem, but the Jebusites ran it and owned it. He hadn't thrown them out yet, but he would. So I don't know exactly what he did with the Goliath's head, but he took it there. And he put his weapons in his tent. So he kept Goliath's weapons. And when Saul saw David going out against the Philistines, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" And Abner said, "By your life, O king, I don't know." And the king said, "You inquire whose son this youth is." So David, when David returned from killing the Philistines, Abner took him and brought him to before Saul, and the Philistine's head in his hand. I don't know how long he carried that head around with him. Might have tied it to his waistband, you know, and just wore it for a while. After a while, you know, it might get a little stinky. But for a while, he's carrying it around. And Saul said to him, "Well, whose son are you, young man?" Now remember, David's been playing the harp for Saul for some time, so he apparently never inquired as to whose son he was, because it is that family that's going to be taken off the tax rolls. So they're going to get the reward, so he's got to find out who it is. So he's asking about it now, and that may be the explanation for why this seems like a strange question. And David tells him, "I'm the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." So David carries the day, doesn't he? What a story. It is an illustration of walking by faith and the victories, the blessings that can be and will be ours if we can do that, as compared to walking by sight, which the rest of the army was doing. They were scared to death of this guy. The odds don't seem to matter a whole lot here, do they? Humanly speaking, one would think that the giant has the advantage. But not when God's servant is doing what God wants him to do. It's the servant David that has the advantage here. And so the nation meets their new king, and he's in this role. He's in the role of killing this giant menace to them. And they routed the Philistines big time on that day. So quite an experience for this young man. And it sets him on a path to knowledge from the rest of the nation, knowledge of him by the rest of the nation as to who he is, what character he has, and so on. And his star will do nothing but rise from this point forward. Saul's star does nothing but descend from this point forward. It is a motif of people moving in opposite directions. A godly, obedient servant is progressing and is being blessed by God. A disobedient, self-serving servant is going to be just on a downward trajectory for really the rest of his life. So this start to David's monarchy, to his kingship, is an extraordinary one, but it's just the first of many blessings that are going to come his way as he goes forward. Probably we ought to stop here, because we can't get through this next section very quickly, so we'll just pause here and give you a chance to ask questions or make any comments. Another vivid example of divine providence in the life of this young man. All sorts of little detail here worked out by God so that David would be blessed. Yeah, Bob.
You know, you think about this, you think about Israel. Today, what does that tell you about Israel's ability to defend themselves?
Mm-hmm. Now, the difference between Israel today, however, and some of the events of this particular story, is that Israel today is not essentially not a believing people. The blessings of God will come to them at the end of the tribulation period in great form in the millennial kingdom. But for now, they're kind of on their own, and they're going to experience some very difficult times during that tribulation period, the worst in their history, as a matter of fact. But later on, when they're on the receiving end of God's blessing, then they will indeed be taken extremely good care of by Him. Yeah, Bessie.
Verse 37, where, you know, Saul told David to go and leave the Lord be with you. And when I look at that and read that, I see that both David and Saul at that time had faith in God. Pride hadn't come upon Saul at that time, right? Had he started not following the Lord, or was he was following the Lord at that time?
No, Saul has already disobeyed God to the point that God was grieved that he ever made him king.
Oh, okay.
Saul has burned his bridges with God.
So
and
it had to be God that, it had to be the Holy Spirit that had, because he said, go and may the Lord be with you. And then David went with no armor, whatever.
Yeah, that's, it's hard to understand
so
Saul's motive, isn't it?
He was still following the Lord, and he understood that.
Yeah, I don't know if that's anything much more than just kind of a common greeting or common statement for him. Go and do well, son. Good luck type of thing. Because there's very, very little indication of spiritual sensitivity and discernment on the part of Saul once he disobeyed God and God sort of cut him off. So there's not much left there from him. As we'll see going forward, he just deteriorates even worse and becomes a totally unpredictable character. Yes, Gene.
What's your take on the five stones? Thank you for asking me.
I think David probably sized up the situation, and he thought he could get off five shots if he had to before that shield bearer could get to him. He knew how fast he could do this thing. And the distance there between Saul and him and all, I think he probably thought, well, if I don't get him with the first one, I can get probably several more shots off before that guy could get that shield to him. So he just took five instead of 10.
My veterinarian had taught a Sunday school class and was in there one day, was expounding upon five stones, and his take was that the others were for the brothers of Goliath, the family. Now, I mean, you can research that and see how many brothers he had, but that was his thing. He found it somewhere.
Well, Jonathan kills, I think, one of the Goliath's brothers. And there were clans of these giants, and they did have usually multiple brothers and so on. I think he's probably, in essence, just loading up the sling for how many times he thought he could maybe use it if he had to. If he missed the first one, he gets, you know, two or three more shots off before he ran out of stones. Yeah, Peggy?
I also read that some people think Goliath didn't have good vision at all when he said to David, come up here close. Have you read any of that? That his vision was...
He didn't have good vision after David hit him. I don't know about before whether vision was an issue or not. That could be. I mean, that could have complicated his situation. But his greatest mistake was not having that shield with him. This thing could easily have been defeated with a shield. He could hit that shield five times and nothing would have happened. But he didn't have that shield to block David's stones, and that's what left him vulnerable. And just that portion of his forehead was all that was fatal. He could hit him in the face, you know, with the stones two or three times, but it wouldn't kill him. But he hit him right where it was fatal, right in the forehead. And I don't know if the stone killed him, but I feel confident chopping his head off did. But the stone might have killed him at first. It said it did, but then it also said he chopped his head off and killed him. So I'm not sure what actually was the cause of death.
Goliath thought the whole thing was a big joke.
Yeah.
And number two, I'm not sure his reflexes would be enough.
Well, when David dropped that sling to put that stone in it, he probably, if he had that shield, knowing what he did as a warrior, he would have thought, uh-oh, this guy's got a weapon here that is, I got to watch out for. So I would think he would know enough to get behind that shield. But if he ain't right near it, and David could reel off five shots at him, you know, he's in real trouble. Yeah.
Wouldn't that shield bearer have needed to be 10 feet too?
Right.
Because if he's by, you know, he could lift it up.
I don't know that he had.
The fall could have killed him.
Yeah.
Because what is in the middle of your head that would kill any of us?
Your brain.
Well, your brain, but I mean, people have bad falls and not everybody dies.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if the fall could have.
I think he was at least unconscious if he wasn't dead.
Yeah, that killed him because he fell forward.
And I don't know if the shield bearer had to be abnormally large just to carry the shield. If that's all his job is, he could probably carry a shield.
But he had to be high enough to cover his face, didn't he?
Well, no, Goliath. If he got it to Goliath, Goliath would cover his face. The shield bearer just had to get it to him.
Oh, he just carried it. I thought he was the one that put the shield.
No. He's just carrying a thing, so Goliath doesn't have to carry it. He could hand it to him and say, here. Protect yourself against these rocks.
Yeah,
Lori, did you have a question?
Same thing. This guy's going to have to be as tall as Goliath.
Yeah.
That makes sense. He was just
curious. No, he, like you say, he thought it was a joke. He saw no real threat to this scrawny kid with a stick until he dropped that sling, and then all of a sudden he was in trouble. And that shield wasn't close enough to help him out.
The ESV version I have says that the stone knocked down Goliath. David pulled out the sword, killed him, and then chopped off his head.
The stone definitely got him down on the ground for sure. Now, my Bible says the stone actually killed him, but, you know, and he knew he needed something because he ran to get his sword. He's not just casually mucking around there. He knows he's got to finish this guy off before the armies come in, if they did at all. So he got to that Goliath's sword in a hurry. Well, at any rate, he took care of business, didn't he?
Yeah, that story's done.
Yeah. Well, all right, we'll let you roll, and we'll see you next Thursday, Lord willing. Have a good week. Stay well. I beg your pardon?
David was.
Well, he didn't know of the family, apparently. He knew David.
Earlier,
well, he knew he came
Jesse.
From Jesse.
They
he
tell
knew
them,
David came from Jesse.
When he first shows up, he says, I'm from Jesse.
Jesse the Bethlehemite?
Yeah.
Well, Saul is such an idiot that he may have just not picked up on
this
it.
This is some of, if not the hardest bone in your body.
Is that right?
Right here. I was in a surgical case one time. A guy attacked the sheriff's department, and they shot him, and they hit him right here. He was alive. We had to replace his forehead. The company I work for.